Hi, I'm Molly.
And I'm Jamie, and this is our From the Pasture with Hired Hand podcast. As the owners of Hired Hand website software, we've been developing websites and creating internet marketing strategies for livestock breeders for the past 10 years. The majority of our customers are involved in the breeding of registered animals, such as Texas Longhorns, Highland Cattle, horses, and white-tailed deer, where the pedigrees are very important. The From the Pasture with Hired Hand podcast examines many of the differences in raising pedigreed livestock for maximum profit. Join us and learn what we're covering today.
Today I'm here with Ben Stone of Double S Ranch in Kempner, Texas. Did I say that right?
Kempner, Texas.
Well, thanks for joining me today.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having us.
Of course. Why don't you go ahead and just tell me a little bit about how you got started in Longhorns?
You know, I've heard these podcasts before, and they always start out like this. You know, in my case, it's a little bit different. I'm fifth generation in beef cattle. And, you know, honestly, by the time I was ready to kind of embark on my own, I was just flat burned out with beef cattle. And I remember when I was a little kid, my papa always took me to the stockyards for the cattle drive, you know, and I was just absolutely mesmerized by Longhorns, you know. And I remember, like, I want those. And of course, his answer was absolutely not. You know, he wasn't going to have anything that he couldn't stack eight deep at a feed trough. And obviously, was a little concerned about horn dimension and how that can affect one's health if they're not paying attention. Don't need to elaborate there. And so I was just really never allowed to have any horn cattle. And so, of course, you know, when I struck out on my own, the first thing I did is buy a Longhorn. And I remember I bought her from Glenn Kleiner over in East Texas. Great people. Lonnie is one of the funniest people alive. Love those guys. And I remember I bought her for like $400 or $500. And she's just as brown as she can be. She's small. She's got like 50 inches of horn. I'm going to tell you something. I really thought I had something. I was just thinking to myself, like, this is a big time cow, you know? And her name's Cricket. And of course, like most people, they always keep the very first Longhorn they buy. You know, it's just at a posterity. You really can't get rid of her. And she's at my neighbor's place and moves every day for keeps. So we go over there and say hello to her. But that was, you know, for us, the way we got started in this was just very simple. And of course, like most of the type A professional success oriented people in this industry, anything you're going to get into, you've got to do it to the nth degree. And so immediately we started researching pedigrees. We started seeing there were better animals out there. We started looking at bloodlines and dabbling in those bloodlines. And the next thing you know, we've got a pasture full of cows and I don't have any idea how we got here. It's just sort of like we bought the first cow and then suddenly, boom, we wake up and we're like, wait, where are all these cows coming from?
And how long ago was this?
2.5 years ago.
Okay.
It happens quickly. They just keep having babies, Molly. You know, they
never stop.
They never stop.
Almost like clockwork, right? Well, one of the things we're going to dig into today is kind of the trials and tribulations of new breeders. When we connected about doing the podcast, you felt like you had some advice that you could share, some insight. But before we get into that topic, I want you to tell me a little bit more about where your program is at today, what you're really proud of, and then we'll kind of rewind and get into all the new breeder type stuff.
Yeah. So I'll tell you where the program is today is we're really kind of at a very interesting crossroads. I think we've got a unique blend of genetics. You know, for us, we have cows that we see that really represent the characteristics that we want precipitating through the herd, right? Primarily, when I first got into this, most people, and I think a lot of people get into this, especially these new breeders, and they're like, I want big horn and loud colors. And unfortunately, they overlook the one thing that I sort of knew about just being in breeding in beef cattle for years and years, and that is you want the ones that are the best mothers. They're going to raise the healthiest calf. They're going to get pregnant after 60 days and have you a calf every single year, right? But unfortunately, that's not what you see represented at auctions. You know, it's all about which one has the best pedigree, which, again, obviously tells a lot about what that animal is going to do as a producer. But it's more about horn length. It's more about showmanship and the flash of that cow, et cetera, body size, et cetera. And so for us, you know, we kind of got away from that originally, Molly. You know, we got sucked into the excitement, exhilaration of buying at auction. You know, we got sucked into the we have to buy a cow at every sale, you know, mentality. And we got away from knowing what works and has worked for how many thousands of years of animal husbandry. And that is you go for the best producers. And so we know we've identified the cows that are the best producers for us. And a couple of them have great horn and a couple of them are really pretty. And so we're trying to take those individuals and really trying to reproduce that, right? We do buy cows at auction now, but it's very few and far between. We've gotten to the point where now we're, you know, forming relationships. That's probably the most thing, or the thing that I'm most proud of is the relationships that we formed along the way. I mean, for us, the thing that got us into the industry was the cows. The thing that keeps us in the industry is the people. You know, we love the community. We're at home in the community. You know, a whole year is planned around futurities and sales and longhorn related events. And so for us, the friends and now almost like family members that we have as a result of being immersed in this for 2.5 years is just absolutely incredible. But in terms of the herd and the directions that we're going, you know, we want to go out there and see the herd. I want to see her walk around. Right, I've returned to my roots and looking at cows almost like we do with beef animals. I want to see her walk around. I want to see her bagging milk. I want to see breeding records and vaccination history and really get a sense of what this cow is going to bring into our herd, and not in terms of just genetics, but reproducibility as well. And I think that's something that new breeders often forget, because I'll tell you, a lot of breeders, at least as far as I know, in a good deal of cases, they don't have a lot of history with cows. You know, this is in some cases their first purchase. And so they get into it and they're relatively blind. And I think that they fall into those mindsets that can, you know, 2 years, 3 years down the road, you look at your herd and you're like, I don't know where we're going here. And I think that's a very scary feeling. And then we got pretty darn close to it ourselves a couple of times.
So let's talk about that a little bit more. So what advice would you have to new breeders to kind of not hit those pitfalls early on, you know, in their journey?
It's super simple. And we fell into this, again, in and out of it a couple of times. And that is, you don't have to buy a cow at every auction. Don't go to an auction looking for a cow to buy, right? And that's difficult, because when you get there, it's like you see the cows in the sale catalog and you don't like the pedigree, or she has never had a calf, and you get to the sale and you're like, oh my gosh, we got to have this cow, you know? And I'm more guilty of this than my wife is. You know, I give her a hard time, but at the end of the day, it's me driving this, just in total transparency. And then the second thing is, find cows that you like. You know, and I know that I remember Ann Gravitt told me that. Jimmy Jones told me that. Dale Metz told me that. You know, Nancy Dunn told me. All these breeders have had great success in the longhorn industry. Buy cows that you like. Well, that's great advice, but I think new breeders are bewildered by that statement because they don't know necessarily what it means. I mean, because if you ask me, what cows do you like? I like them all. You know, I mean, I think they're beautiful. You know, I think every single one of them has unique characteristics that can add to, you know, something to your herd. And you may have to look for it in some cases. And for some, it's not so obvious. And for some, it is. But what I mean by that is, find that cow that you like. For me, it's Alfie's Jamaicanism, right? I think that is the most perfect cow. And I think she's so big and so deep and so long. It's like a beef cow with gigantic horns and beautiful color and great disposition. Mm-hmm. You know, that for me was like, when I saw that cow, I was like, I want that. I want every single one of my cows to look like that. And when you see the breeders that have been doing this 30 and 40 years, Jimmy Jones is one of them. And I was fortunate enough to be able to nominate him for a TLBA Hall of Fame just recently, in which he was inducted. And really what did it for me is going down and seeing his herd. They all look like that. And the reason they look like that is because he saw a cow in his mind that he was trying to build. And he worked backwards from that, you know? And I think a lot of new breeders, and I'm telling you, we did this, right? We were very close to doing this. As a matter of fact, Dale Metz is the one that kind of said, hey man, slow down. Think about what you're doing here, because you're about to spend a lot of money on this and you need to be sure that it's what you want. And not in terms of being a part of this membership and longhorn breeding, but just like the animals that you're purchasing, because they don't look that similar. And so you need to be aware of this. So I started thinking in sort of slow rolling this and walking backwards and thinking, okay, what it is do we want? What kind of horn shape are we after? What kind of colors do we want in these cattle? Do we want big cows? Do we want small cows, right? Are we looking for one? Are we looking for cows that are, you know, great mothers? Or are we just buying based on skin complexion and horn conformation, you know? And so you have to think to yourself as a new breeder, what do you want this cow to look like? And then once you have that cow in mind, then you can start buying cows that closely associate and already come with that software sort of pre-installed. And they already have some of the characteristics you're looking for. I mean, granted, for me, the cow that I want is worth way more money than I could spend on animals, right? And I think that's 99% of people. And that is, you want to try to get as close to that at auction or at private treaty. And then you want to try to breed those characteristics into that using artificial insemination or embryos or bull partnerships in order to get you closer to that animal that you find to be most attractive.
So how many of those points, like you kind of rattled off maybe 7 to 10 characteristics that you feel, you know, the animal has to meet. How many of those are negotiable, or how many does a cow have to check those boxes before you make the purchase?
Yeah. And I'm talking like I know what I've been doing this for 30 years. I haven't. I mean, I've been around cattle my whole life, but longhorns are completely different, you know, and everything that I find out how little I know every single time we breed a cow and get something that we didn't expect. So please take this with a grain of salt. This is just one new breeder's, you know, meandering through starting a longhorn herd. But I'll tell you, the number one non-negotiable is reproducibility and motherhood. And that's something that, to be honest with you, Molly, I got away from that. And I very quickly found out the hard way that that is very often underrated. And I want cows that are going to be great mothers. I want bulls whose bottom side has phenomenal producers who are awesome mothers that milk a lot, you know? And again, having been steered in that direction, we got kind of lucky because the genetics that we were big on Ketchikan genetics, we're big on Jimmy Jones breeding. We just recently partnered in Goldmine, and we kind of doubled up on Ketchikan. We're partners in Jeremiah 2911. So we kind of doubled down on Ketchikan genetics, which for me, that is one of the most, or best producing bulls, you know, in the history of the breed, you know, that and concealed weapon, which we're very big on as well. And just because that bottom line, that dam side is such a phenomenally, traditionally great line of mothers. And I think a lot of new breeders, and I'm going to get back to your question in a segment, I think a lot of new breeders need to spend more time and focus on which of those maternal lines are the best mothers that produce the best offspring, that milk the best from all the way from the time they're a first calf heifer to the time they've had their 10th or 11th cow, you know, that's something that's non-negotiable for us. And I used to overlook it. You know, I used to think I'll just bottle feed these cows if I have to. And, you know, and I think a lot of it's out of arrogance, to be honest with you, you know, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. I know what I'm doing. That's not the case with these cows. I'm just telling you. And so that is for us, that is non-negotiable. I won't even look at a cow unless I can see a breeding history and some examples of what she's put on the ground. The one thing that's so negotiable
Let me ask you this before you move on to your second non-negotiable. But when it comes to mother ability, milk ability, that maternal line, you obviously research it ahead of time through their pedigree and their offspring and all of that. What type of assessment do you do in person once you see the cow?
You know, I'd like to see her with a calf, you know, which I know oftentimes you can't, but there's a lot of pictures out there of these cattle, and usually breeders and owners are great about taking pictures with and without calves. I'm looking at teat structure. I'm looking at udder length. You know, I'm looking at just overall hip set. I want to make sure that, you know, this is going to be an unassisted birth. So I'm not out there at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, in freezing weather trying to pull a calf. I've done that many times. I'm not a fan of it. You know, so we look at the cow structurally from the back as a composite, just to make sure that I don't see any biomechanical deficiency that could potentially limit that cow's ability to deliver a healthy big baby, right? That's going to be a lot less stress on her. It's a lot less stress on the calf, and it's going to produce offspring that generally are healthier, right? Now we don't get as crazy as like checking colostrum for vitamin deficiency or anything like that. I mean, I have done that before. That's not something that we've done yet, but most of it is just a visual inspection. You know, do those udders work the way they ought to, right? Can you tell if they've been nursed before? Is there one quarter that's just not producing, you know? And so if I look at that udder and I see anything wrong with it, I'm not saying I won't buy that cow, because one of our best cows has the most jacked up bag you've ever seen, and she milks like crazy, you know? Now, would I choose to buy her again? I don't know. And that could be a big mistake, right? So it doesn't always work out like that. But as a rule of thumb, that's really what we're looking for.
Perfect. All right. Let's go on to your second non-negotiable.
Well, the second thing I was going to mention is a negotiable, and that's horn tip. You know, and this is something I learned from Nancy Dunn. She's like, Ben, we can breed horn tip into these animals. You know, she's had, I can't remember exactly the name of this cow, but I want to say it was Dunn Lucky Penny that sold at auction at Legacy last year. or the year before, I can't remember, $400,000+. Her dam is like 75 inches, you know? And so for me, I'm not necessarily concerned about tip to tip, as long as those horns have the right shape. And like most people, not necessarily most people, but like a lot of people, we like a really tight symmetrical twist, right? The only thing that I try to stay away from as a new breeder, and this is only because I've seen this propagate through several different herds. I mean, the internet is a very powerful tool. You know, I was talking to Terry King about this, and he said that him and Nancy and Jimmy used to drive around and look at different ranches. You know, every week or month, they would go to a different ranch. I mean, I can visit 30 ranches from the comfort of my own couch every time I want to, right? So if I see a maternal line that has something in it, I can follow that, right? Just based on the fact that most of these breeders are great about uploading photos. Now, what I was going to say is asymmetrical horn for me. Now, you can call it my obsessive compulsive disorder, which I probably should be medicated, but I cannot stand that. Absolutely hate it. Some people don't care. And they can say, well, I'm going to breed it to a bull that's like a rowdy, that's very corrective, right? But I've seen those asymmetrical horns follow down through generations of dams. And that for me, I don't like that. You know, I just, it's not there's anything wrong with that cow. It's purely visual. It's purely aesthetic. It's like a scratch on an otherwise perfect truck. It makes no difference. But for me, I just don't want that in my herd. And so that's the only thing regarding horn that we just won't purchase.
Okay. So when you're looking at, you mentioned that, you know, not a world, a record breaking tip to tip isn't a deal breaker for you, right? So when you're looking at these animals that you're thinking of bringing into your herd that maybe don't have the wow factor with the tip to tip, how many generations ahead are you having to think with your breeding strategy and your bulls and your planning for where you know you can get them?
That's a great question. And honestly, that generational paradigm is really something that we have. We're very new to that. You know, I'd say within the last like 6 to 8 months. And so we've started thinking like two moves ahead, right, with these cows. So we just partnered in a bull, Horseshoe J Bodacious 244, and that's Jimmy Jones breeding. Comes out of Horseshoe J Latitude, which is a 91-inch beautiful cow. I mean, she has the Jamaicism's, Alfie's Jamaicism body. She's got great tip-to-tip, very lateral horn set and perfectly symmetrical. On the top side, you've got Power Wagon, which is showing some remarkable pedigrees now, right? Some remarkable offspring. And so we're very excited about Bodacious. You know, he's, we measured him just the other day. He's gigantic, number one. I mean, he looks like a water buffalo, and he's the most gentle bull I've ever been around. He's like Ferdinand. I mean, you can walk up to him and pet him, and he's just super sweet. But his horns are incredible. I mean, he's predicted to be 100+ inches. And so, you know, right now we're taking, actually thinking, trying to think 3 to 4 generations ahead. And that is, I'm finding great success with 20 gauge over Jeremiah progeny. We've got a couple of heifers from him that show incredible potential, and they're absolutely bite the back of your hand beautiful, stunningly beautiful. We're looking forward to getting them in futurities. Once we're there, if they don't have the color that we're looking for, we're going to breed them to Goldmine. Now, he's no spring chicken, and so I'm kind of bumping him up in my order because he's not going to be around forever, and you can have all the heifer sex semen in the world. Right. But it's not like having that bull. And everyone knows this. If they have color, then we're going to skip Goldmine and we're going to go straight to, which I think if they don't have the horn, then they're going to get the horn from him. And okay. So Jimmy has actually got the first crop of calves from Bodacious hitting the ground. I think like now I want to say he's had a couple already hit the ground. So we're excited to see how they produce. But for us, it's I take an imperfect cow. Because again, I refuse to spend more than $10,000 to $12,000 on these cows, and for reasons that we can discuss in a moment. And I'm adding, in some cases, 20 gauge, in some cases, Goldmine, and I'm going straight to Bodacious. Right now, this experiment with Jeremiah and basically the catch of checks over concealed weapon, you know, that's something that I want to continue because Jeremiah is a young bull, and I've got a lot of 20 gauge daughters. And so I think that'll be kind of a side sort of a experiment, if you will. But we're trying to think really three generations ahead.
So do you, because I feel like you have a great vision. You obviously, you know, are very informed on what you're looking for. Do you feel like that you should even still consider yourself a new breeder? Or do you feel like your beef background really kind of gave you a jump start that most take a few years to figure out?
That's a great question. The only thing the beef industry taught me how to do is feed animals. You know, people that come out here and look at our cows are like, man, these cows are thick. and they're not over-conditioned, but they're fleshy. You know, they're fleshy. And one of the reasons they're fleshy is because I've seen... Now, Longhorns, obviously, are a lot different in terms of just general stature. They're hippy. They're not quite as fleshy. You can see their ribs. It doesn't mean you see their flanks. It doesn't mean they're underfed. That's just the way they are. But I found my vet bills are a lot lower, and we keep our cows up, especially through the winter, right? We don't have to worry about intestinal parasites as much. We don't have to worry about infectious diseases. They put out more milk. They raise better cows. They just genuinely do better. You know, once you do the manual labor of getting them up to where they ought to be. Now, again, I'm not a fan of cattle that are overconditioned. You know, you may have heard me in Futurities before when we see some that have come across the judging stage, and I'm thinking, my goodness, like that cow is never going to have calf, right? Especially when you start to get those fatty deposits in the reproductive tract, that can definitely slow them down in terms of their reproducibility. So that is not what I'm talking about. But that's the one thing that my beef background taught me how to do is to medically take care of these cows, to feed them to where they're going to produce with minimal interference from me.
And so what would you say?
Well, do I consider myself a new breeder? Yeah, quite a bit. There's a lot in this industry that I don't know. And I'll tell you, just the history of where it's come from is an advantage that a lot of these 2 and 3 and 4 decade breeders have over me. I don't have perspective, and they do, and that's a very important thing.
That's a very good point. Well, let's touch on the subject you mentioned previously about what you're willing to spend on animals and why and where that kind of fits into your plan.
So it all comes down to money, right? You know, here's the deal. And I hope I don't break any eggs with this one, but I'm just, for me, I always think about risk reward in any investment, whether it's professional or relationship or whatever. It's what do you stand to get versus what actually you put into it. And so for me, I remember when I was a kid, I had a show bull, and I was trailering him around and probably could have been paying closer attention, but to be fair with you, I had a car pull up in front of me and basically cut out and die in the middle of the road. And I ran off the road to try to avoid it because I could tell there's multiple occupants inside that car, and flipped the truck and trailer and killed the bull. You know, I was unharmed. The truck and trailer were completely totaled. You know, bull didn't make it. And I thought to myself, that has changed me permanently. I don't like trailer and cattle just for that reason. But I thought to myself, you know, doing this longhorn breeding experiment, that could have been a $100,000 cow. You know, you get those cows home and they step on a rattlesnake. You know, you get them home and they get an eye infection. You know, you get them home and they get struck by lightning under a tree. And so for me, when I think I can't afford to take $100,000 and light it on fire, right? I mean, some people can, I can't. It would hurt. It would set me back a decade or more in your savings, you know? And so we don't have the capacity, like most people, don't have the capacity to do that. And furthermore, this for me is recreation. You know, I did this as therapy from PTSD, and I enjoy the heck out of this. And I don't want to make it stressful. I don't want to make it such that I've got so much on the line and now I have to make it successful, because that drains all the fun out of it. You know, and I found as well, if you pay attention at auction or at private treaty, the relationships you make in the industry, you can find cows all day in that $5,000 to $9,000 cost bracket that are phenomenal cows. They're a little bit older, which who cares? You know, and that was something that Nancy Dunn impressed upon me. I mean, some of the first cows we bought were like 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And they're our best cows on the property. I mean, I just had a goldmine heifer out of Rio Check Beauty. She's a 2011, best mother ever. You know, she runs around the pasture like a heifer with her tail out. You know, as long as they have good mineral, you know, we worm them, we do multi-min twice a year. I mean, we really take care of these cows, right? So if you're willing to invest in these older animals, Longhorns can breed all the way up into their, you know, I was talking to Ann Gratt. She's got a cow that's 20 years old that's putting calves in. So if you take care of these cows and invest in their health, they're going to produce for you. And they come at a much lower cost than, say, an amazing heifer that shows, again, it's a risk. I won't even get into that. Something we really don't do is buy heifers. But, you know, you don't know what's going to happen with that cow, and they always go at a premium, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. The oldest cow we have on the pasture 2 years ago gave us our best animal, which was a double S20 blue bonnets. It's a 20 gauge daughter. Her dam is out of Tejas Star. Phenomenal cow. She was the one with the terrible back. The cow that she nursed that's in futurities that absolutely crushes anytime she's in a competition is huge, you know? And this is out of a cow that, as she stands here, you know, today, I mean, she's like a, I mean, she's a 2000, I want to say she's a 2010, so she's 14 years old. And she just had a bull calf, and he is phenomenally healthy, right? Out of Goldmine. And so for us, if we study our pedigrees and we stay awake during auctions and we go and look at ranches and invest in relationships with people, they want you to be successful. I've had people like Dale sell me cows because I was getting started. I'd done the homework. He knew I was going to be successful and take care of this animal. It was going to a good home where it was going to be cared for, and probably sold me that cow for less than what she was worth, you know, because I was going to do something that he didn't have room for at his place or whatever. And we've seen that happen countless times. And so if you're willing to do the homework and do the due diligence, you can find those quote bargain cows that are bred to a great bull, are going to continue to reproduce for you for years. And you don't have to spend $30,000 or $40,000 to do it.
So maybe getting off topic here a little bit, but I'm going to put you on the spot. So you go to these consignment sales with your budget and you have your cow picked out that meets all your check boxes, and she gets about couple hundred dollars from your price range you're willing to pay. Do you or Nikki find yourselves having to sit on your hands, or do you break the budget a little bit, or how does that situation go?
No, we break the budget. You know, I mean, that's only happened a couple of times, and luckily it was on a cow that was like $4,000, you know, which I say that like, oh, it's no $4,000, it's no big deal, whereas for most people it's a lot of money. For us, it's a lot of money. For some reason we don't think about that when it comes to our cows. I saw a funny joke the other day, and it was a rancher, and you know, he's driving this little broke down pickup truck. It was like a cartoon. He's at the store, and there's a pair of shoes. Like, oh my god, a pair of boots, $200. That's crazy. I would never spend that much money. And there's a cow in the back of his trailer with like a $10,000 price tag. But in those circumstances, it's funny. Nikki and I will look at each other and like, hey, if you want this cow, I'll get it. You know, like trying to put the ball in her court. She's like, I don't want to tell you what. So it's like back and forth, but we normally, you know, if we see her, you know, and we want her, we'll at least bump it up a little bit, but we certainly will not put ourselves in a position. And the few times where we've been outbid, actually I got outbid at Horn Showcase. There was a cow that I wanted, and I think Randy Murray took her home. Beautiful cow, by the Stagemullers, and she just went above the budget, and I had to watch her go. And I told Nikki, I said, man, I really wanted that cow, but I'm actually kind of relieved because I'd gone over my budget a couple thousand dollars, you know, but I really wanted her. And the following week, we end up buying a beautiful 50-50 daughter from the Hudsons through Mike Willinger. And it's just, again, it was sort of a God thing. You know, I mean, we didn't spend that money. We actually spent less money on the 50-50 daughter, and I think got a better cow. And so, again, to my new breeders out there, it's fun. But don't get carried away in the exhilaration of bidding at auction, because, you know, you get buyer's remorse pretty quick. And once that hammer slams down, you know, Dan Huntington's a pretty nice guy, but I don't think he's going to back that one up for you.
Probably not, no. So what was your advice that you were going to share with us about buying heifers, or your take on that, I guess?
You know, I got burned a couple times in the beef industry on heifers, you know, and... Obviously, Longhorns, so many benefits of that breed. Unassisted live birth, I think, is like the biggest, most underrated. And that is with beef cows. It's all about who's producing. You know, if they have a tough delivery, you'll still breed that dam the next year because you know she's going to put a nice, you know, cow on the ground, or maybe a bull that you're going to be able to run across the scale and make some money with it. But I'm employed full time, you know, and I'm running a business with 117 employees. My wife works for our organization, and we've got other things going on, and we don't have time to devote any more time than we already do to this operation. And so they've got to be able to get out there and have a calf and nurse it with basically no help from us, right? Unless there's a major issue. And so for heifers, I want to see a proven track record of reproducibility. Heifers don't have that, you know? And so I'm not saying that I wouldn't buy a heifer, but it has to be from the right person, from the right bloodline, with the right attributes before we'll actually go down that road, just because I don't want to inadvertently purchase a.
That makes sense. So a few of the things you've touched on have had to do with events and sales and networking and making friends. How important do you think that it is for new breeders to go to several events, you know, whether it be before they get involved in the breed or, you know, very early on?
It's necessary. You know, it's not just a good idea. It's something that you absolutely have to do. And I'll tell you, that's the most fun. You know, I mean, I think futurity is the most boring thing in the world. I love going. And here's my favorite thing in the world is seeing somebody like Wayne Manning. And I'm sitting behind him. He doesn't know this. And one of his cow, beautiful heifer. Well, I think she won her class and probably got reserve grand champion. Gorgeous, gorgeous cow. And I said something to Nikki. I was like, God, you would think they check these animals for Yoni's disease before they bring them to a futurity. And he turned around and saw me and started laughing, you know. And that is the most fun in the world. And we sit there and we talk the whole time, you know. And so the community of people is truly unique in this industry. In the beef industry, it's about one thing, money. That's it. In this industry, I'm not saying that money's part of it. 90% of people, if you really ask them in their most lucid moment, money's not the reason they're doing this. They're doing it because it's fun, because the animals are beautiful, they have a lot of personality, and the community of breeders is just unbelievable. So if you're a new breeder and you don't immerse yourself in that, number one, it's a bad idea to build your brand, but you're missing out. You're just missing it because that is the most enjoyable part about this whole experience.
What about ranch visits?
Yeah, I love it. Love it. You know, we don't get a lot just because of where we're located. We're kind of off the beaten track, like most people. And we're relatively new at this, Molly. So I don't think a lot of people really know who we are. But we do have people that stop by and take a look. We recently just partnered on one of the bulls that we bred as a Jeremiah son out of one of our best producers, most beautiful cows on the ranch. And his name is Double S Tiger King. My wife names these animals. I don't. I would have never allowed an animal to be named Tiger King. Okay. Just for the record, that was a Nikki idea. But we just actually partnered him with W2 Longhorns down in Fredericksburg. And that was based on our ranch visit. We had some people that looked this up, said, hey, can we come look at your herd? And I said, absolutely. And the next thing you know, we're talking every day, talking about cows. He's got some Longhorns, bought two or three from us, and then partnered in Tiger King. And, you know, that's just been, his name is Jimmy Walsdorf. He's phenomenal. I mean, him and his wife are just some of the nicest people you'll ever meet in your life. And so, again, our circle is expanding, right? Just based on the interactions that we have for people that stumble through our cattle gate.
Do you and Nikki also still go on a lot of ranch visits, just trying to kind of continue that education of what you're looking for?
We do when we have time. You know, we do when we have time. Unfortunately, you know, being employed full time, running an organization, you know, it's tough. It really is. The majority of our exposure that we get to other people's animals are through futurities, right? We're big into futurities. And it's funny because I didn't know anything about futurities. I have nothing about them. I didn't even know how to spell futurity. I mean, we did futurities with horses when I was a kid, but never with livestock, cattle, you know? So the very first futurity we did was Winchester. And I want to say it was in 2021. If Nikki was here, she could tell me. Like most wives, she remembers dates really well. We got dead last. Because, you know, we got there. And people are leading these cows around by lead ropes. And I'm thinking, these damn things are halter broke. You know, we've got like the Tasmanian devil in the back of this trailer. You know, I've never halter break her. I don't want to die. You know, she was a sweet cow. But she's all, I mean, literally, I plucked her out of the pasture and put her in maturity. And, you know, it was funny because they did the Calcutta. And I didn't know what a Calcutta was. And Brent Boland was up there doing it, God rest his soul. And no one bit on our animal. Of course, he didn't know who we were. And he goes, a swing and a miss. You know, because everyone saw her and she wasn't clipped up. She wasn't very big. You know, and of course, she's matured into a beautiful animal now. It's actually one of the longest horned Jeremiah daughters. She'll reach 80 inches at 4. I think that he's produced. And she's actually gave us a beautiful, beautiful calf out of 20 gauge. But she was in there and got dead last in her class and was pretty much close to the bottom. And so we just started seeing it. We're like, we like this. This is fun. You know, I get to look at all these other genetics, you know, find out what's working, what's not, who's there, who's not, meeting people coming to introduce themselves to you constantly. And so immediately we were addicted to that. So we waited a year And then Tejas Sue, which is the oldest animal we own with the messed up bag, she put Bluebonnet down on the ground. And we took her straight to Futurities. And I think she's won just about everyone that she's been except for Millennium. And so she's done quite well. And of course, we knew kind of what the standard was and we tried to rise to it. But I'll tell you that for us doing ranch visits is just hard, you know, because of where we're located in Central Texas and just the amount of time. We really rely on the internet to do a lot of our ranch visits for us.
Love what you're hearing? Be sure to check out our pickup truck confessions. It's a video series where we hop in the truck or rental car and interview a variety of breeders about what drives their passion for their livestock, how they got started in the breed of their choice, marketing tips, and more. And now back to the podcast.
So obviously being a business owner, you probably have your hands in everything from financials to marketing to, you know, just the whole gamut. And you touched on it a little bit earlier when you were talking about feeding and the confirmation that you're trying to obtain on the animals. How strict of a financial plan do you follow for the program, or do you kind of just let it operate like a hobby?
It's a great question. You know, we don't have a budget. We keep a smaller operation. Even after our cows have calves, I think our last one hits the ground in April. We did winter calving this year, which we kind of got lucky with the weather. We had one cold snap. Now, hopefully, and saying this, I haven't just doomed the entirety of Texas to another Arctic blast like we had in 21. So maybe edit this part out just so that doesn't happen. Yeah, but our last calf hits the ground in April, and I think we'll be up to like 41 head of cattle total, right? So we try to keep a small operation. This year is the last year I'm letting it operate as a hobby. I'm going to start financially tracking. I just wanted to see, you know, for a couple of years what we're spending on this. And I'm not saying that there's just like an unlimited ATM for cows out there, right? We obviously have financial constrictions like anyone else would. But I've been letting it run just kind of itself, making good sound decisions, thinking about the future, but just letting it run. And then, you know, after this 2 years of information, we're going to go back and look at this by the month so that we can start to budget for this as the herd continues to grow.
Would you give that similar advice to new breeders, or do you wish you would have had a budget right from, or, you know, I know you said you don't want to call it a budget, but, you know, do you wish you would have had that right from the get-go?
It probably wouldn't have changed things much, to be honest with you. Like most people, I buy the maximum number of cows that we can pasture here without doing damage to the grass, which is tough in Central Texas, especially west of the 98th, you know, west of 35, because it's just like completely different climate over here. You know, in East Texas, they've got a lot of rain, a lot of improved grasses. It's flatter. You know, the soil is different, different composite, different mixture. And so it grass just generally does better there. Hay is easier to come by. But I'll tell you, just, you know, watching my grandfather, Papa, you know, I've seen him go to so much trouble in financial projections and none of it come through because of a drought or something, which we've been having, you know. And so we literally started, like breeders in our generation of breeders, we started breeding cattle. It probably the worst possible time, you know, based on weather patterns. You know, we were feeding hay in July of last year. We were feeding hay in June the year before. You know, we got very little rainfall. You know, there's been a historic drought. There's no water. And so we've been spending a lot more money in doing it and just maintaining the herd under those circumstances. So even if I would have had a budget, I think it would have been almost impossible to follow.
Too many outside effects, basically.
Yeah. And that's the old saying in beef cattle, right? Is, you know, I remember someone asked him, hey, how's the cattle business, Charles? And he's like, great, made $1 million. And they're like, really? That's pretty great. He goes, well, the problem is to start out with 2 million, you know? And I've seen years where I remember when I was a kid, you know, he took 30 or 40 head of cattle to the sale. And I was young, but I could work a calculator. And I remember counting up and it was like $86,000. I was like, oh my God, he's rich. You know, and then the next thing I know, you know, he has, you know, 200 rolls of hay delivered, you know, at $50 a bale. And I'm thinking, well, so much for that $86,000. You know, and so again, I think in the cattle industry, it just ebbs and flows, which is what makes it so difficult. You know, so now for longhorn breeding, it's a little bit different. You can stabilize your income and capital expense, but you have to be very specific about what you're doing. And there are, of course, environmental factors that are completely out of control, such as agriculture, right? That's what makes it so difficult. But I definitely think more than having a budget, setting limits for spending and building your herd methodically is probably a better idea.
What haven't we covered that you feel like would be helpful for new breeders to know?
You know, here's something for my old breeders. When you put a futurity on or a sale, for those of us who haven't been to it for the last 20 years, put the location and the date and the sale time like on the front cover of the magazine. You know, we're new at this, right? So it's like there's sales we want to go to, and I'll flip through the magazine page after page after page after page. And finally on page 13 at the very bottom, I'll see the sale starts on Saturday at 9 a.m. You know, and I have so many new breeders I've talked to on this. They're like, man, you know, I think they just rely on these sort of rote expectation of these unwritten rules and this code of conduct that you follow. And no one really knows what it is, but you just have to kind of be a part of this tradition for years and years before you finally realize how it works. You know what I mean? And I'm okay with that because that's just, I think, you know, the way we do things here in Texas and especially in other rural areas. But as professional as this becoming, that's something for my old breeders. If you want to help out the new breeders out there, you know, give better information, clear instructions of what you need, what you want, how to sign up. If you want to consign an animal, here's a list of things you have to do in order to qualify. If you want to put an animal in futurity, here, you know, so again, there's less guesswork that goes into it because, like, I think most new breeders, you get very intimidated, right? You don't want to be a standout. You don't want to be recognized for doing something stupid or asking a dumb question in public, right? So you just kind of sit on your hands, you keep your mouth shut. And unfortunately, that's how people become very disenfranchised very quickly. And I think in a lot of cases, we wanted to consign animals and just couldn't find, I talked to someone about it and they were running the sale and kept spitting this vocabulary at me and I didn't know what it meant, you know? And so finally I was like, you know what, forget it. And I didn't do so begrudgingly. But it was a very polite, you know, it's okay. Thank you very much. We'll pass on this, but we'll try to figure this out next time. Just because, you know, I could tell they were getting very frustrated. And so the expectation there for these new breeders, you know, a lot of these individuals that are involved in this and have had great success have been doing it for a number of years, right? And they're getting to the point where they're thinking about maybe permanent retirement, right? Getting out of cattle. So the torch will be handed to that next generation of breeders, right? Help us out. Arm us with that information. And give us more direction and clear communication on what you need from us. And we'll participate more. But I think a lot of new breeders get very frustrated with just a lack of information. And they think, you know what, I'm going to skip this one. We'll maybe catch the next one down the road. So I think their participation could be higher if there was a little better information coming from our leaders in the industry.
That's great advice. I thought maybe where that story was going is that you and Nikki showed up at the wrong time or the wrong place or the wrong state here at some point. So
we have, you know, and I'm not going to tell you which sale or where it was, but we have done that. And actually we were not the only ones. There were several people there. Young.
Hopefully
in this
it
industry.
Wasn't a long drive.
It wasn't short.
Oh man.
But no, we stayed an extra night and went to the cell on the following day. But yeah, it was it just wasn't clearly communicated in the magazine. I even brought it to the attention in a very polite, respectful way to the organizers, and they were like, Yeah, we see that, but it's just always been at this time on this day. I'm like, I've been doing this for 24 months. You know, I don't know, it's always been done this way. You know, I'm fine with that. I'm not trying to change it, but just help me out here because I want to participate.
Well, I'll definitely take that to heart with all the sale catalogs that we work on. I'll try to push to have the time, place, and location, you know, on the front cover for sure.
Just do it so that you have these non-observant, dumb doctors like myself that don't pay attention, that aren't very detail oriented, right? And just want it to spell out in plain English. And if you can do, act like you're talking to a 5-year-old, and then suddenly we'll sort everyone out.
Well, I feel like that was really good advice. We covered a lot there with that. Anything else that you want to share? Just that you think would be helpful?
Now, we've had such a good time in doing this, you know, and we were talking about this the other day and I can't remember exactly what we were discussing. It was our futurity schedule for the year. And Nikki's extremely organized, you know, when she gets her calendar sorted out. Molly, I don't know where I'm going until I get a plane ticket in my inbox, you know? And so I don't ask those questions. She keeps everything squared away. And we weren't going to be able to make an event that we wanted to make. And she's like, I'm really bummed out about that. And I think it conflicted with a work item. And I was like, babe, we're going to just, this just rolled off my tongue. I said, babe, we're going to do this the rest of our lives. So we'll catch the next one. And when I said that, it was sort of this great sense of peace overtook me. And I thought, my gosh, like, I want to do this forever. You know, I don't ever see myself leaving this industry. I don't ever see myself not being a part of this community. You know, this is, we have truly found a home here. And it's a home that we are prepared to stay for a very long time. So we've enjoyed this, and I could not think. I know that I was giving a little bit of grief to my older, more long-term breeders out there, but truly all credit where credit is due. And in all due respect, you guys have made it amazingly accommodating, very enjoyable, and have been so welcoming to us and other new breeders that we just can't thank you enough.
So one last question before we go here. You know, you've mentioned where you started considering yourself a new breeder, and then you've mentioned the folks who have been in it for 20, 30 years who have their systems down. How many stages do you think are in between those two that you have yet to experience?
That's a great question. I can't answer that. We're still in the having only bulls and no heifers stage. And so I haven't necessarily learned how to get to the, you know, so it increases your satisfaction. But I'm not sure, you know, there's some awards that we obviously want to earn. There's some benchmarks in terms of the quality of animals. And I think the price they go for at auction. I found it's interesting. And that is, Neil Merriman, Neil and Stan are probably the two of the most enjoyable people I've ever met in my life. And they had a Horseshoe JNS that they sold at Legacy, I think, for $115,000. You know, it's interesting. When you talk to those people, they couldn't care less about the money. And I'm not saying that anyone wouldn't take a $115,000 check if you gave it to them. But for them, it's more of just the recognition and, hey, we have a cow. We bred a cow that was worthy of that kind of value. That's the real honor in the whole transaction. It's not depositing a check in your bank. Sure, that's fun and it's great. But it was just the recognition and understanding and the realization that we bred an incredible animal. What we're doing is working. And so that's the next step that we want to get to, is putting these animals up for consignment or private trade that carry a premium, and not because I care about the money or the price, but just because I want to advance. I want to be known for very high quality animals that are very medically sound, that outproduce themselves. And I think that's the next benchmark, right? And what goes on beyond that, I don't know. Maybe you stay in that cycle forever. You know, you ask Jimmy Jones, you know, what's your ideal cow? Have you ever gotten there? He's still looking for it. You know, of course, anyone who's ever seen his herd will tell you that they're the most remarkable herd of longhorns probably on the planet. But for him, it's always in search of what's next. And so I think that's what makes this so appealing and so addictive, is that you never quite get what you want, but you produce some amazing animals and make some amazing friends along the way.
Well, when you get there, we'll circle back and we'll do a follow-up podcast.
I'll let you
tell us all about everything else you've learned.
I'll let you know.
Sounds good. Well, thanks, Ben. I enjoyed it.
Thanks very much, Molly. Have a great day.